The other wall was all the nails, and they were at different levels, and they were fairly big nails. They, you know, they, like, that's why they stood out to me, is that this row of nails across were big, you know, so that's what I saw.
I've heard my pop felt responsible for his siblings and the abuse they suffered, and that he never got over the guilt of not being able to protect them. I've also heard that my pop did get the occasional beating, but I don't know for sure. There's something else I haven't told you yet. Not long after 9/11, my pop was diagnosed with dementia. Anne-Marie and my grandmother suspected something was going on, and listening to Anne-Marie describe the house, there are details in my pop's Holocaust story that bear a striking resemblance to that description. It's starting to make sense now, just how this whole story came to exist. Despite their suspicions, I don't think anyone in the family thought that Pop was capable of imagining a story as elaborate as he did. Here we are again, Anne-Marie and I, in the Gander Cemetery last fall. She's telling me about the people in Gander who confronted her after reading Jim DeFeedy's book.
Sometimes people are very sympathetic, sometimes they're not, and, you know, I react to it according to how I feel. If I think a person understands dementia, then I'll explain it to them. If I think they don't understand it, I really don't answer them. Because, you know, it was Dad's story that he told.
I knew that my pop had dementia. Some of my visits with him toward the end were traumatic. Sometimes he was best kind, carrying on as he always did. Other times, he didn't know who I was. I remember once he got really angry with me. He was blind from his diabetes, and he had asked me who I was. I said, "It's me, Justin, your first grandchild." He just started shouting, clenched his fist, and took a swing at me. I didn't know how to handle a situation like that, so I pleaded with him not to hit his grandson. Well, he suddenly snapped out of it and started crying. I think that was the first time I ever saw him cry, and I was heartbroken. So, had my pop's dementia set in before 9/11? With the exception of my grandmother, Anne-Marie spent more time with Pop than anyone else, and she says he was showing signs of dementia long before he was diagnosed.
It hurts me to hear those stories that the rabbi told, because I know my father, and I knew his dementia very well. And, you know, I can only imagine what Dad was feeling in the confused state of telling that. And I'm convinced even more now after hearing the rabbi that this was all a result of pressure, but also his dementia. And the pressure not coming from the rabbi, but from other forces.
She doesn't say his name, but she means Dave Shaw. Emery mentioned several times in our conversations that if only Dave Shaw had told my grandmother he was bringing my pop to see the rabbi, my nan might have asked some questions and heard the story before it was made public, and perhaps she could have intervened. Since that didn't happen, our family's left to deal with the fallout. But Emery now has the chance to clear the air, and although these are difficult things to talk about, she's intent on setting the record straight.
Some of the things that the rabbi said about the family being together are definitely not true. We were never, like, all together when Dave Shaw showed up to give him his gift of his walking cane, because we didn't know any of the story of the Jewish stuff, so that never happened. Nobody would have embarrassed Dad in front of Dave and said, "You can't carry that," or "You can't use that," or anything like that. What we probably would have done was, we probably would have got Dave away from Dad somewhere and said, "Dave, do you realize Dad has dementia?"
You know, one of the reasons why the rabbi seemed so convinced was because of the wounds.
I remember Dad's head. Like, many times I massaged Dad's neck from his shoulders and all that, especially in his last years when he was sick. And I never felt anything out of the ordinary on Dad's neck or his head. So I just think that's wrong. It was the same thing about the toe story. I mean, we all know that Dad carried on about his toe for years and years and years with the children. And he used to talk about his big toe. Dad had a big toe. I mean, no two ways about it. I have a big toe, too. But when the rabbi was describing how it extended like a thumb, there's no way Dad's toe came off his foot like that. So there's something wrong in that part of the story.
And was his big toe, regardless of how it extended, was it the way it was because of abuse from childhood?
I do believe the part of the story about the children being extended by their feet on the nails, because I remember that story. I remember, like, Dad didn't talk a whole lot about the abuse, but I remember a story about him and his brothers being tied upside down by their feet. But he said feet back in the day when I heard it, and it was him and his brothers. So he could probably have had some kind of damage to his foot and toes because of that. But it wasn't from, you know, the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at Dad and look at all of his brothers and sisters. There's no mistaking that they are family. Like, you just go through the generations, and not just because we look alike, but Dad actually has a birth certificate, you know? And it's just, the other story just seems, I'm not saying that it hasn't happened to people,
mm-hmm.
but what I am saying is that Dad did have all kinds of things happen in his life, all kinds of trauma.
Here's my Uncle Greg, Anne-Marie's husband. He worked for my pop for years, looked up to him like a father, and had a pretty good son-in-law-father-in-law relationship. And then he looked after my pop in his final years.
Ed was a storyteller. We all know that. He was really good at children's stories, rhymes, all kinds of things. He was an amazing storyteller. And I think as he got older, dementia, something happened that he told a story, and then the wrong people got a hold of it. Not the wrong people, but this story then became real life or something. I don't know. I can't say exactly, but then he couldn't get out of it. Whatever. I know that's the wrong term, but there, something happened that it just went from a storytelling to real life.
I wanted more evidence, so I went to Newfoundland and Labrador's Provincial Archives in St. John's.
So here they are. There's not much to it. It's done by date, surnames, names of child.
Perfect.
This is for your grandfather, right,
Edward? Yep. And I found something.
Okay. Break. Where? Right there. That's him. There it is. Humbermouth, railway employee, loader, William and Elizabeth, Edward John, break. Date of birth, May 12th. That's it. May 12th, 36. Okay, I got to take a picture of this.
Proof of my grandfather's birth and baptism in old church records on microfilm. So let's add up the evidence that Pop was born in Newfoundland and not Germany or Poland. There's a government-issued birth certificate and church records of his birth and baptism. An uncanny family resemblance between Pop and my great-grandparents. And living relatives who knew my Pop most of his life and who have no recollection of a single detail supporting the idea that he came over from Europe. No accent, no beatings for acting Jewish, none of it. I also visited my pop's only living sibling, who asked not to be named. She says she was not witness to any abuse and is incredulous to the whole Holocaust survivor story.
Some years later, I was informed that your grandfather had passed away and that he'd been buried with his Jewish gifts. Does any of this ring true with you?
It's really difficult to, that reality or that possibility has been flatly rejected by all members of the family that I know.
I told Rabbi Sudak my family doesn't have any evidence to substantiate the Holocaust survivor story. I also told him we do have ample evidence that he was born and raised in Newfoundland. I also shared stories of my pop from my early years and told him that Pop was eventually diagnosed with dementia, not long after 9/11. I email Rabbi Sudak with everything I now know. I send him all the proof I've found, that the story Pop told him, a story that he then began telling, The story that's been performed for years on stage, on Broadway, and around the world is, for a fact, false. He never replied. The whole time I've been doing this research, a few questions have been on my mind. Does any of this even matter? Why bother setting the record straight? Why not just let people believe the story? After all, it's a story that had a positive impact on Rabbi Sudak and on thousands of people around the world, even on the people of Gander. And why raise any doubts about a story that involves the Holocaust? Couldn't that kind of debunking fuel the worst kinds of racist historical denial? On the other hand, if we don't share our individual truths before we die, well, that information could be lost forever. In the play, Pop's character says, "So many stories gone, just like that. I needed to tell someone." That's exactly how I feel, because the story of who my family is and where we come from, that story has changed. Who we are has changed because of everything I've just told you. Who we are to our neighbors, some of whom have accused us of denying or covering up things we know just aren't true, and who we are to each other. We've each processed Pop's falsehood differently, and that's changed how we relate to each other. Some of those stories aren't mine to tell. But there's something else that's changed about us too, something I haven't mentioned yet. It has nothing to do with the Holocaust story. I'm talking about a whole other narrative about our roots that emerged around the time of my grandfather's death, a narrative that my family is indigenous, Mi'kmaq. I have children, and one day they'll want to know where they come from. I need to learn what I can and document it for them, while I still can, before the truth and the evidence to prove it fade away, and before I fade, like Pop did. Because as I've learned, stories take on lives of their own. And like my grandfather, I need to share what I've learned about our family and my time on Earth. So I need to tell you the true story as best I can, even if people here may not want to hear it.
Everyone knows that we have people who have falsified their documents.
People were solicited into joining. People who never ever wanted anything to do with it. They were talked into it. You get this, you get that.
When you say there's no proof, I'll say to you, prove to me that she's not.
That is not a people. That is just ancestry.
That was your Canada Land, Chapter 1 of The Newfoundlander. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I'll read all of them. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website's canadaland.com. This episode was written and reported by Justin Brake. It was produced by me, Bruce Thorson, and Tristan Capicchione. Editorial contributions by Sarah Larniuk. Canada Land's managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Tim Bousquet, editor and publisher of the Halifax Examiner.
Hi, Jesse.
How you doing, Tim?
I'm a bit stressed and tired. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay. Today on the show, Pierre talks with his mouth full, and it makes him famous. Tim, welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
All right, Tim, we're in a bit of a spot here. This is a familiar pickle for me as the host of this show because, you know, we talk shit about the news here. We do not have a say in what makes it into the news. You know, whatever is news, it's our job to talk shit about it. So when something really dumb blows up big, something cynical and trivial, like when a politician just cynically seeks media attention through very obvious intelligence-insulting schemes, and then they get it, well, we have to give them even more attention because it's our job to make sense of what's happening in the news. And with that caveat, I turn your attention to the Apple.
It seems the whole world has seen conservative leader Pierre Poilievre eating an apple.
Pierre Poilievre gave a masterclass on how to handle left-wing journalists.
The now infamous Apple interview.
Canada, please.
Canada.
I've been waiting for this one the whole night.
This is such a good story. A journo tried to take him to task today, and this guy wasn't having a bar of it. He's an absolute legend. His name's Pierre Poilievre. I probably just absolutely butchered his name.
Canadian Conservative Party leader, and I know I can do this, Pierre Poilievre. I think I got it. I think that's his name. Poilievre.
We're in no position to judge the pronunciation on this show. There's been a lot of, what the hell are they talking about? That was the entire world. This was a big deal for Pierre Poilievre. This was like the introduction of Pierre Poilievre to the international right-wing media. This was his breakthrough moment. Fox News took note. The conservative British press heaped praise upon him. Megyn Kelly tweeted, "Can we get him in our country?" What did he do? That was so great. He ate an apple. Okay, I think people need a bit more context. It's possible that someone out there missed the apple. What was this video? So what you're seeing here is an interaction between Pierre Poilievre and BC journalist Don Urquhart, editor of the Times Chronicle. And what listeners cannot see here, and I guess it's the pivotal aspect of this, is that while he's doing this interview with a reporter, conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is chomping on an apple.
On the topic, I mean, in terms of your sort of strategy currently, you're obviously taking the populist pathway.
What does that mean?
Well, appealing to people's more emotional levels, I would guess. Certainly you tap very strong ideological language quite frequently.
Like what?
Left wing, you know, this and that, right wing. You know, I mean, it's that type of ideological thing.
I never really talk about left
but
or right.
Anyways, a lot
I
of
don't really believe in that.
Okay. A lot of people would say that you're simply taking a page out of the Donald Trump book.
Like which people would say that?
Well, I'm sure a great many Canadians, but...
Like who?
I don't know who, but...
Well, you're the one who asked the question, so yeah. You must know somebody.
Okay.
And it goes on like this.
Yikes.
All right, so I think that Pierre, whether he knew that this was going to happen or not, you know, you got to wonder when, like, chomping on the apple before the reporter starts that line of questioning, he's already just dismissive and smug and, like, showing the guy no respect. Like, you know, this is a conservative party leader doing an interview with a journalist who theoretically represents the public and their right to know, and he's just like... Got a very f*** you attitude from the start. Did he know that it was going to go this way? In any event, he knew what he had after he had it, and he tweeted it out with the killer burn, "How do you like them apples?" and releases this, and it blows up widely. Do you think, Tim, that this is like evidence of Poilievre's masterful jujitsu flip of the left-wing press, or is it more evidence of the incompetence of this one reporter?
Well, I think it starts with the incompetence. He certainly just fed that. He was... utterly unprepared for this interview. You don't go into an interview with someone like him just asserting things. You need evidence, proof, citations. That's just bad reporting.
I mean, if you wanted to go down that road
and you did your homework, it's like a 10-minute Google session. Rather than say you're kind of a populist, right? You know what I'm talking about. You could specifically cite Pierre Poilievre. You have embraced conspiracy theories like that the WEF is ruling the world, that Davos elites are in charge of everything. You've warned against the Great Reset as some menace, globalism, which is a coded word for an international Jewish conspiracy. You've embraced the trucker convoy. You have falsely asserted that Trudeau plans to make digital IDs mandatory. That's not true. You also pitched crypto as a way that Canada could get out of inflation right before crypto lost like 50% of its value. Like, you could back up if you wanted to say that, you know, to answer his questions, what do you mean by populist? There's plenty that you could, if you have just done some basic homework, there's plenty of stuff you could have brought up.
That's right. And instead it was just this vague, oh, you're a populist, period.
And then to this question of whether he's divisive, whether he pits the right against the left, which he says, I don't really talk about that. The Liberal Party, they had their kind of comeback, and they actually put together a sound pack that I would have been happy to have put together for this show or worked with my colleagues on. Let's hear the Liberal Party's response to that.
Radical leftist authoritarian, this prime minister's leftist ideology, Marxist government, socialist policies, big socialist governments, radical leftist agenda, the socialist policies of the NDP with the government, liberal NDP, radical left, champagne socialist, leftist authoritarian.
I never really talk about left or right.
Chomp, chomp, chomp. I don't like that left versus right stuff. That's not me.
Yeah, the problem here is that the liberal video will get, you know, 1% of the coverage as the original did.
Yeah, I mean, the truth will you know, what does Fox News or the Australian or British media give a damn whether he was just completely lying? It's a wicked burn clip. It seems to prove something about how reporters are trying to stitch up right-wing politicians or conservative politicians, and all you got to do is just calmly swap them away and ask them to back it up, and they'll fall apart. And the fact that it's really just the fact that this guy didn't know what the hell he was talking about because he didn't bother to check is of no significance to everybody who has embraced this clip. So I don't know. I don't know what to say.
I think the lesson is get prepared for your interviews.
I think that's absolutely the lesson that we should take from it. I also feel like there's sort of a depressing takeaway on the wider scale, which is like, we, you know, doing this work, you kind of hope that the truth has a force and a power all of its own. It feels like kind of the truth feels pretty weak in this instance.
Yeah, for sure.
I think, Tim, and I'm very happy to leave the apple chomping episode behind us and move on. But I do think it's worth highlighting, not just because it happens to be in the news, but because I worry with some certainty that it's this kind of nonsense that the coming election is going to be fought and won on. That it's these viral moments. And Canadians, even here, it's like it gets another round of attention. The fact that it got attention gets attention. And there are stories from the CBC on the fact that Pierre Poilievre has been noticed internationally. And that just kind of makes it a snowball in which, you know, the fact that it's all predicated on nonsense just doesn't matter at all. Tim, you have been on the show before. You know that we like to take some time to duly note news stories that more people should know more about. What do you have for us today?
Well, I have a sad story, Jesse. You know, our industry has been hit very hard. You know this. We've had the loss of advertising, the consolidations, the layoffs, the hedge funds closing entire chains, on. Yet we still have people out there doing reporting. It's not because there's big money out there. It's rather just sheer force of will of individual people devoting all their time and effort to prop up these little organizations popping up here and there around the country for not much money. It really is just a labor of love. And I've been thinking about this for a long time lately, and that's because, you know, the Halifax Examiner is probably one of the more successful local startups in North America, and we struggle. You know, I'm 60 years old. I'm in good health. And I've got some years left in me, but I try to think about what retirement looks like, and I'm having a hard time getting there, figuring out, you know, how the Examiner keeps going on without me.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring this up is that there are smaller operations that are even more stressed than the Examiner. And I'm thinking specifically of the Cape Breton Spectator, which is a one-person operation run by Mary Campbell. Mary has done fantastic work over the years. I really admire her journalism and her commentary. Mary has recently taken ill. I don't have details, but last month on September 13th, she posted that she faces some health problems and won't be writing for a while. And last week, her family posted on the site announcing they were pausing the Spectator. That's all I know, but it's a huge loss to independent journalism in Nova Scotia and Canada, frankly. I guess, you know, when the money is exhausted, when there's no big financing coming in to fund media, all there is a bunch of fragile humans, and we can't go on forever either. And I think this is a sad illustration of that. I just really want to note Mary's situation.
Well, I'm glad you did, and I think that we talk about these tiny operations sometimes in like very in sad tones, and it sounds like the circumstances are sad. I hope to convey to people like a sense of hope and inspiration around this, because it's not simply about this person's great and they're doing great work with very little resource. It's that the only thing that's working in Canada right now, that things have been tried on a corporate level, on an investment level, on a government policy level, on a getting big tech to pay for it level, the only thing that seems to be viable are these tiny operations. It's the only hope we have for maintaining journalism in Canada. So it's just crucial that people support her organization, that they support the Halifax Examiner. It's like all we got is us, you know, and it's just going to be up to Canadians. Do we want to keep this stuff around or not?
Yeah, and it's really, you have to support those people in your community who are doing that hard work for not much money, and frankly, it affects their health and their future, you know?
I'd like this to get to a place, and I think it is possible, where it's like, it is inspiring and amazing that like some people are able to just do it at all, because that is an impossibility in so many places. But we can maybe do a little bit better than that, and maybe we could actually have things like healthcare and, you know, unions and pensions, and like, it, you know, it is possible, but in smaller communities, it's incredibly hard. Duly noted. Duly noted, Tim. Tim, that is that's our show for this week. That's Shortcuts. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, Jesse, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. Our website is CanadaLand.com. You can email me about anything you heard today at jesse@CanadaLand.com. I read every email I receive. Tim, where can people find you and your work?
I'm still have a somewhat of a presence on Twitter, although I'm trying to get out of it.
Yeah. That's what they all say.
Tim_Bousquet, Bousquet. And you can email me at tim@halifaxexaminer.ca.
Check out The Examiner. It is worth your time and your support. This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called Syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. We'll be right back.